The Myth, the Man, and the Menace, an Oral History of King Eugenides of Attalus. This talk was given at the 2021 Redefining History Conference in Mela on behalf of Pod Together 2021. It is presented by Irrational Pi and transcribed by LC2L. Far back, before the sky caught fire, is the traditional way to begin a fairy tale in Attalus. For many years, this was seen as a quirk of language, a quaint but meaningless version of Once Upon a Time. But in the last few decades, excavations at sites around the Hephaestial Mountains suggest the history of Attalus may well stretch back long before the eruption of Aetius, in which case it is very possible that some of their folktales are older still. My name is Dr. Genia Caracas. I'm a historian at the University of Feria, but I was born and raised in Henactos, a small town on the Sunan coast in northern Attalus. You may know Attalus. It's a popular holiday destination, famous for our wines, our olives, and our long-dormant volcano. The history of our country is largely written by outsiders. The Aetian eruption threw out lava flows and ash that covered 80% of the land. Whatever cities and history we had was buried under molten rock, and it's only in the last century that the land has recovered enough for farming to resume. The city of Roa is older than the volcano, but the Great Fire in 1075 burned through the library and the archives, and our stories were lost. So we rely on our neighbors for our own history. For a long time, the primary work dealing with Attalus has been considered to be the Mede accounts. The final chapters of the first act of the Books of Nehelid speak of a country that seems to match Attalus, and a war fought in the land where Roa now stands. But considering the account is wholly concerned with a war, and a war which the Mede must have lost, given that I am Attalian and not Mede, it seems strange to accept our enemies' accounts as gospel. But if we have no written accounts of our own, historians will say, what choice is there? The key word here is written. Our folk tales are not your folk tales. When I first came to Feria, I was shocked that no one knew the story of the King and the Thunderbolts, that no one could sing even one, let alone the customary 20, verses of the man with a hook for a hand. History lingers in stories, captured in metaphor, diluted but still present, and it is up to us to compare the oral traditions to the written accounts and find the truth in them. I am going to perform these pieces as they were performed to me as a child. There will be a transcription available of everything that I recite today, and if you are interested in the full pieces from which I have only pulled excerpts, my book, A Thousand Nights Beneath a Firestorm Sky, contains all these and more. And now that that is out of the way. Far back, before the sky caught fire, there were three kingdoms at war. Sunnis, the wild ocean. Aetius, the mountain filled with fire. And Attalus, the Silver Land. The king of Sunnis wished to make the mountains of Aetius his bride. They loomed too tall, he said, and thought themselves so high and mighty. He demanded that Aetius come down to his land at the bottom of the ocean. He stole rocks from the mountains and hoarded them to build a palace of stone. He sent waves to crack the rocks and form the cliffs of Roa that still stand to this day. But Aetius refused him. They liked standing tall under the blue sky and did not want to bow down to the Ocean King. So the ocean tore at the mountains, and the mountains stood firm, and Attalus was caught between them. Until one day, the ocean had a son. The prince did not hide like his father in the stone halls. He would travel to the beach with the tides, to the sky with the waves, and even up onto the land with the rivers and the lakes. One day, he was traveling up the Superchia River when he saw Aetius for the first time. His breath caught, his heart stopped. His father had always called the mountains rough and hardy, but seeing them with their snow-capped peaks, their sides robed in forest, the water falling from their cliffs and valleys, the prince knew they were beautiful. And he knew that if they were diminished and brought under the ocean, their beauty and splendor would be lost with them. Aetius also appreciated the young prince, who walked among her peaks without demanding anything in return, who asked for nothing but to look upon her. But she was a queen of all peaks, and he was only a prince, and they were doomed to remain apart, seemingly forever. Until one day, a storm struck, stronger than any storm before, bringing a ship of invaders from across the sea and a terrible plague that struck the king's court. By the time word reached the prince, the king had fallen, and one of the invaders had usurped his throne under the sea and was forcing his people to pay tribute and to form an army to march upon Aetolus and Aetus to bring them all under the waves. The prince of the ocean followed the rivers to the capital city of Aetolus. There he asked the Anax, the king of kings, for an army to return to the waves and steal back his kingdom. In return, he promised Aetolus that the ocean would bow before him. The storms would not batter his coastlines, the waves would not overturn his shoreline, and the currents would not drag his ships onto the rocks. Aetolus sent a single force of men to the waves, and by twilight they burned the invader ship so the prince could slip through and return to the heart of his kingdom. But he was captured by the usurpers who had stolen his palace and turned even his own people against him. They stripped his crown and his fine cloak and locked him up awaiting trial with nothing but his shirt and a small box carved from olive wood and inlaid with silver, a gift from the king of Aetolus that none of the invaders could open. The prince waited 30 days and 30 nights before he was brought into his own throne hall, to an audience with the usurper king who is sitting upon the prince's throne of coral and pearl. "You have stopped the waves for a king who has given you nothing," the usurper said. "A single force of men, a box that cannot be opened. It is no wonder your people would choose me when you have sold their country away for nothing." The prince looked back at him, then at his people, cowed and bent around the walls. "Not for nothing," he said, then drew the pistol out of the olive wood box and shot the usurper once through the heart. A moment later, the doors were thrown open, and every soldier there has ever been serving in Aetolus flowed into the room. The prince turned to his people in the walls around the room. "I make the king," he said. No one dissented. The prince sat upon the throne of coral and pearl, and the crown was placed upon his brow. His first act as king was to write to Aetis in the mountains. "I do not ask you to tear yourself down," he wrote, "or to move into the sea, but I would love you to the rest of my days if you would allow it." And Aetis was so moved by his love that she sent part of herself into the ocean, creating the islands off the coast which stilled the waves and calmed the currents, ensuring that soon as his promise to Aetolus was kept and the three nations came together as one country under Aetolus' protection. And so it was, and so it remains to this day. Thank you. In my book, you'll also find the sequel to this, which picks up the story of one of Aetis' mountains, who wasn't happy with the agreement and went on to become the Aetis volcano. But I'm going to move away from my country now to the written histories of our neighbors and pick up some verses from a well-known Brailish epic. Notice the similarities, the references to three kingdoms, this all-powerful king, the twists on conventional approaches to warfare. "Come, soldiers and farmers of fair Braille, greatest of countries, greatest of men, hear the tale of a far-off land, where three kingdoms united under one man, and the largest army of the sunset lands rode forth to meet them. In a space of land beyond the Melon Plains, mountains meet the forests, meet the sea. Fractious, eternally they fought, brave and bold with sword and cannon, until one man who saw the future dangers called all of them together. The man from the mountain stood before the crowd. He was no king, he wore no crown. But when he spoke, the wind stopped to listen, the waves were still, the fighting ceased, and he bade them join their forces to march to war. But though the men were brave and fought with great honor, the numbers against them were so great they had no chance at victory until the king rode forth in the dead of the night. And by morn all was left in disarray, a victory stolen from defeat, the mighty force disbanded on the plain, run back into their rabbit holes, and the kingdoms, having fought and died together, united forevermore beneath their king." Thank you. That's one of my favorite passages. What's interesting here is the reference to stealing. Most wars in Baelish literature are gloriously fought, the victors the pride of their groups, but this story suggests something underhand. The Baels are clearly dismissive. They diminish the notion. But in Atollis, we love stories about thieves and trickery. This next one requires some music. If you were at an inn in Atollis, everyone would join in on the chorus, and then they'd corner you after a pint to tell you all the verses that you got wrong or missed out. Every town has its own version, and you can track back every petty feud they've ever had. I have researched many renditions of this song in many a tavern all over Atollis. I'm not going to say these are definitively the original verses, but they crop up more often than most. This song is traditionally a drinking song. Please try to resist the urge to quaff your coffees, if only because they are still fairly hot.
Oh, I know a man in vagabond clothes who stole a king's seal from under his nose and stole his magician with decoys and doubt, then stole a whole navy on his way out. Oh, what can you steal with a hook for a hand? Oh, I know a man with a hook for a hand. He stole all the ships that were moored on the sand. Oh, with a hook for a hand, then took the king's seal from a palace so grand. Oh, with a hook for a hand. Oh, I know a man who stole from the gods, took a rock from a temple the river had lost. Oh, I know a man who stole a queen's heart and rescued a country from falling apart. Oh, what can you steal with a hook for a hand? Oh, I know a man with a hook for a hand. He stole all the hearts from a faraway land. Oh, with a hook for a hand. Then stole the gods' jewels from the palms of their hands. Oh, with a hook for a hand. Oh, I know a man who said he'd steal peace, and he stole it and he spread it from mountains to sea. Oh, I know a man who said he'd steal war, and he stole it and he won it, oh, that one and more. Oh, what can you steal with a hook for a hand? Oh, I know a man with a hook for a hand. He never surrendered, he always would stand. Oh, with a hook for a hand. And forged us a peace that no man could disband. Oh, with a hook for a hand. Oh, I know a man who stole a gold crown. Oh, with a hook for a hand. He took it and he kept it and he still wears it now. Oh, what can you steal with a hook for a hand? Oh, I know a man with a hook for a hand. The king of all kings, the lord of the land, the annex, the thief, and only a man. Oh, with a hook for a hand. Oh, with a hook for a hand.
Thank you. Thank you. There are many gods in the history of this world. In Atollis now, we are mostly Nuptican, brought from our friends in Malenzi. Before this, we worshipped the Sumaean gods, and that is as far as most history goes, but we can go back further with our stories. Stories that start with the earth and sky, living gods who interact with the world and each other and their children, the most famous being Hephaestia, the great goddess, Moira, the messenger, and Eugenides, the god of thieves. Any child from Atollis could tell you the story of how Eugenides was given by the earth to the blacksmith as a son, and how the soot of the forge turned his skin dark like the Nymbians on the far side of the sea, and how Hephaestia took the high throne of the pantheon from all the gods who would have married her and taken it for themselves by placing coleus root in her wedding cup and letting them drink from it one by one. But the story I'm telling today picks up long after all of those classics. Hephaestia is on her throne, ruling both the gods and men as great goddess and queen of Atollis. And again, I ask you to consider the intersection between man and myth, between folklore and history. Did the gods come down from the heavens to deal with the day-to-day cares of men? Or have our stories been passed down so many times that real people from our past have been forgotten? Their stories passed on to the names that are still recalled? This is the story of the engagement of Hephaestia, adapted by me from multiple sources. Far back, before the sky caught fire, the great goddess Hephaestia sat upon the throne of Atollis, She entreated with the gods, of the rivers, the forests, and the skies, to bring great fortunes in silver to her people. And she entreated with her people, the farmers, the landowners, and the soldiers, to worship their gods and respect the land they walked upon. And she sat upon a dais on a single throne with no king beside her. Her mother, the earth, had given her the power to shake the land, and though her father, the sky, had not yet given her the thunderbolts that he'd promised, she was able to maintain control of her kingdom and protect it from all outsiders. But a person cannot rule alone forever. Through the day, she dealt with the people. Through the night, she dealt with the gods. And exhaustion started to pile upon her. One day, Nazresh, an invader god from across the sea, came to Atolus. His beard was oiled into spikes, and he bore great caskets of gold and jewels to bestow upon Hephaestia. He praised her beauty and her grace to her face, but he did not believe a woman should be ruling a country, and he had been sent by his gods to take over Atolus and change their temples so they would worship his gods rather than their own. Eugenides heard about the arrival of the foreign god. He went to his father the blacksmith, but he was busy with work and had no time for queens. He went to his mother the earth, but she had promised the sky that she would not intervene in the activities of men, and said he would have to figure something out himself, using his cleverness and cunning. Eugenides traveled to the palace of Atolus. He slipped unseen through the hallways and stole half the guard. He stole Hephaestia's golden headband, and he stole the high priest of the invader gods. Still, Nazresh did not leave. He sat on the dais beside Hephaestia on a silver throne, gave her jewels to make up for those that were gone, and she kept him always by her side. Eugenides left the palace and headed to a lake where Earth's husband, the sky, regularly lay down to sleep. He wore a cloak of moleskin so that if the lake or the sky looked, they would think he was only a mole in the undergrowth, and so garbed, he snuck up upon the sky and took the quiver of thunderbolts from his side. That night, Hephaestia found them in her bedchamber, laid out beside her robe. She went to thank the sky for his gift, and he could not say they had been stolen, for he had promised them to her, but she saw in his eyes that they had not been a gift to her. She put this together with the missing headband and the guard, and realized it must be the work of Eugenides. So she spoke to the sky, and she spoke to the earth. The sky told her where to lay a trap to catch him, and the earth warned her to hold the traditions and not offend the rest of the gods by acting out of place. The trap worked. Eugenides was captured and brought to the throne room of Hephaestia where, in keeping with ancient traditions for dealing with thieves, she used her sacred powers to remove one of his hands. After all, what can a man steal with only one hand? Eugenides was cast out of the palace and was not seen again for a very long time. In Hephaestia's court, jewels remained in the lock boxes where they were kept. Fine cloaks did not vanish and reappear as horse blankets, and the sky's thunderbolts remained in their case in the corner of Hephaestia's room, for she did not wish to return them in case she never got them back. But she could not bring herself to carry them when Eugenides had broken all her locks to get them to her. And in the silence and the peace, Nazresh remained in the palace. He sat beside Hephaestia at dinner. He stood behind her throne at court and advised her. He suddenly seemed to be present in all places at all times, like Eugenides had somehow been keeping him away. Then one night, the court was attacked by demonic figures coming through the woods from the north. Like shadows, they broke through the castle's defenses. The goddess's guard leapt to her side, and Nazresh called his guards up to defend the castle. But the demons seemed endless, and their shadows stretched long. Hephaestia's guards were called away to the fighting, save one man in a helmet and a red cloak, who was instructed to take the goddess to the hidden pathways and out of the castle. She followed the guard down a secret passage. Down they went, down and down and down, until it seemed like they must have walked all the way out of the world, and then they reached a boat carved from black marble and resting in a river that ran gray laced with silver. Tsubia. The River of Souls. Hephaestia looked back for the stairwell, but it had disappeared, as the path to the underworld only goes one way. And in its place was the guard, removing his helmet with a single hand, for where the other should have been was only a curved silver hook. "If you want to escape," Eugenides said, for of course it was he, "I cannot stop you. But I can take you back to the surface, where this river will only take you down to the delta of the dead, and even you, great goddess, have no power over the oceans of eternity." Hephaestia looked in all directions, but found only shadows in the river. The underworld is a strange realm, filled with mysteries which the gods themselves know not. But Eugenides was a favorite of the earth, so perhaps it was true that he knew an escape. She gathered her skirts and climbed into the boat. The marble craft cut through the water like a whisper, barely stirring the souls flowing around it. Eugenides steered silently past shadowed monuments, ruined cities, and shapes too otherworldly to name. There was no sun in the sky, so she could not count the days, but it seemed they traveled for years. It seemed they traveled for hours. It seemed they traveled for moments. "If we are here too long," Hephaestia said, "I will have no kingdom to return to." "If you marry Nezresh," Eugenides said, "you will have no kingdom to return to." Hephaestia drew herself up in the front of the boat. "I have made no promise to the invader gods." Eugenides gave no response to that. But barely a moment or an hour or a year later, the boat slipped out of the current and drew itself to a stop against a hint of a shadow. Eugenides climbed upon it, holding out a hand to Hephaestia, who did not take it, but stepped out of the boat onto the strange land. And there, on a shadow of a spit of nothing in a sea of souls, Eugenides made his proposal. "If you have made no promise to the invader gods, you could marry me." Hephaestia laughed. "Has your mother, the earth, sent you to ask this of me? Does she care for you so little?" Eugenides shrugged his shoulders, and she realized that he was young. Too young. "I am asking you." Hephaestia looked at him, then at the river which still surrounded them on all sides. "It seems that I have no choice," Hephaestia said. "So very well." Eugenides nodded, then gestured behind a shadow not 1 foot from where she stood, and said, "After you." It took her a moment to see it, from the corner of her eye, a stairway between 2 motes of light, but her feet found the path solid and sturdy beneath them. She began to climb. The path was long, leaving the river behind, and with it the slight shimmer of light, so instead it was pitch black, only the motion of her feet constantly finding steps to guide her. She spoke to give some shape to the darkness, and to reassure herself that he still followed, for his breathing was silent and his feet made no sound. "I suppose you will want all of my temples to become temples to you," she said. And Eugenides replied, "I have my shrine up in the mountains. I am happy with it, and it alone." Hephaestia walked for another age, then said, "I suppose you will want all of my worshippers to come to your shrine and worship you instead." And Eugenides replied, "I have the thieves who worship me with every rooftop they run and lock they break. I am happy with them and them alone." Hephaestia walked further still and said, "I suppose you will take over leadership of my kingdom. Sit upon the throne, and make the laws your own while I sit in shadow." And Eugenides stopped walking, and Hephaestia realized the darkness was lifting, and in something like twilight she could see his face as he looked up at her. "All I want is you," he said. "You may rule as you see fit. I would be happy with you, and you alone." And Hephaestia knew he was naive to believe such a thing could happen, and a fool to wish for it. "I, who trapped you and cut off your hand? Why would you wish for me?" Eugenides looked at her, the light of the dawn catching upon his face. "I love you." And Hephaestia knew that he was the god of tricks and thieves, and that his very nature was to lie. "If I reach the top," she said, "I'm sure you have men who will hold me to my word. So I will marry you, but I will not believe you." And Eugenides was silent for a long time, as the twilight grew brighter, and Hephaestia could almost feel the warmth of the living on her face. "I brought you the sky's thunderbolts," he said, like a child looking for praise. "Where he would have kept them for himself, I brought them to you, so that you could free yourself from the invaders." Hephaestia almost looked back at him, but caught herself in time. "I have no need of thunderbolts," she said, "for the single god in her court could perhaps be dissuaded, but she knew there were many more where he came from, and his golden gifts were barely a fraction of what their worshippers gave them. And I will not use them any more than I will willingly marry you." Then all of a sudden, or perhaps over another agonizingly slow length of time, they stepped out into the sun and were surrounded by not the thief's men, but the acolytes of the invader god, who bound Eugenides' hands and feet and led Hephaestia away from him. They had been gone for too long. Time passes strangely in the underworld, and when they returned to her court, it was Nazresh who was sitting on her golden throne, wearing rich robes. It was his acolytes and priests who filled the halls while her people were turned out onto the streets. "For your protection," Nazresh said as he surrounded Hephaestia with guards she did not know and did not permit her to leave her own palace. He did not bother to propose, but there were wedding plans being made across the kingdom. Green silk was ordered in for Hephaestia's gown. A hunt was sent out to collect 3 white swans for the feast. Musicians could be heard practicing in all the halls. He sat upon the throne, ruling in regency until such a time as he could claim his crown as her own. Hephaestia sat in her room with strangers as attendants and foreign gold at her brow, cast her eyes to the corner of the room, and ordered a message sent to Nazresh. The next day, she was dressed for court. The attendants braided her hair and set gold rings on her fingers and clothed her in foreign silks from across the sea. Hephaestia suffered their attention without complaint, but insisted on taking a small gold tube from her desk clipped onto the edge of her belt. The trial of the god of thieves brought out the leaders from every corner of the kingdom. The hall was filled from the flagstones to the rafters, save for the dais, where Nazresh had had a second throne installed for Hephaestia to sit upon, and the center of the floor where Eugenides was chained down to the stone with a man behind him, all in black, holding an axe that shone with an unearthly light. "I hope you don't mind," Nazresh said. "I took the liberty of bringing my own executioner. I think we are in agreement that a hand will not suffice this time." Hephaestia smiled. "How gracious of you to think of me," she said. And she stepped down from the dais to crouch beside Eugenides and wait for him to lift his head. It took a minute. His limbs were bruised, his eyes bloodshot, but she saw the moment they glimpsed the gold at her belt. "You asked me a question," Hephaestia said. "In the underworld, when I was at your mercy. Now I am in my own Megaron and have an answer to your proposal. Do you know what my answer is?" Eugenides swallowed. "Yes," he said. "Yes," Hephaestia said. Then she unlatched the tube at her waist and sent a thunderbolt across the room aimed with such careful precision that it passed directly over the oiled hair of Nazresh and hit the sunburst back of his golden throne. The throne split in two. Eugenides stood up beside Hephaestia, the chains falling open on the ground at his feet, and one by one every person in the hall, be they man, woman, or god, rose to their feet. "This country is ours," Hephaestia said. "We do not choose you, Nazresh, and we do not choose your gods. You may leave freely now, or you may take Eugenides' place in the dungeons." Nazresh looked from Eugenides' sharp silver hook to Hephaestia's fingers crackling with lightning, then drew himself up from the shattered throne and fled the palace to his ships and his foreign shore. And Hephaestia took Eugenides' hand in hers. And so it was, and so it remains to this day. History meets stories meets myth. Was the first king of Atolis one of the kingdom's first gods, come down to save the people from the destruction the volcano would bring? What theological canon in this day and age would marry the great goddess of all to the god of thieves? And yet it's consistent. Here is a fresco from one of the ruined cities currently being excavated from the lava flows of Idas. We see Hephaestia in a white gown with a gold band at her brow, and at her feet sits another figure. Brown skin, dark hair, an expression that even centuries later we can immediately identify as shifty. But if we zoom in on the image, we can see something in this image that keeps cropping up in these stories. The god Eugenides holds thunderbolts in one hand, and in the other, all we see is a hook. Now, folk tales are all well and good, but they go through so many adaptations. How my mother tells the story is not how they are telling it next door, and the next town over may be further from the truth still. There are so many details to be switched up and forgotten. But the next two rhymes I have heard from Salik to Roa on playgrounds up and down the country. I'm not going to skip, but I'll clap along, and I'm sure you can picture it. Oh, I know a king who was once a thief. Stole all the land from hill to sea. But habits of old are hard to break. How many gems did the thief king take? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. That's usually as far as I got before the rope caught me out. I had better luck with the clapping rhymes, although they sound better with a partner. Sunus has an ocean deep and wide. Idas has a mountain filled with flame. Aetolus, the olive trees shining bright, all united in his name. Sunus build walls of rock and stone. Idas digs deep for silver ore. Aetolus, thief who works alone. Three makes one to win the war. It might be unconventional to rely on playground rhymes for history, but we see the same themes. A king who is a thief. Three kingdoms united into one. But I promised some more conventional sources, and it doesn't get more conventional than this next one. From the Mede Empire, originally transcribed onto scrolls, but copied and repeated almost identically in a single chain since. It's a reliable text, though it is an ancient Mede, which is extinct as a spoken language, and I'm not expecting you to understand the original. This is an extract from the Books of Nehelin, a 10-book epic poem covering the entire near century of the emperor's reign. A point in Book 7 addresses the Idas eruption, and is worth a read if you're interested in the history of Aetolus, but I will be reciting today an extract from Book 1, Act 3. There are multiple translations of the Books of Nehelin. I have pulled from the more recent work by Dr. Asharat Khan. Although any translation is by necessity biased, Dr. Khan's research into the history and etymology of some of the translation choices was fascinating to me. The use of girl over virgin, and descriptions of women to match the words used instead of modern beauty standards, is a refreshing change from the older translations, and she does a great job of capturing the grandeur. For those who have read other translations of Nehelin, there is one word choice by Dr. Khan that I'd like to draw attention to. Previous works have referred to the leader of the opposing army as the barbarian king, or the heathen king. Both of these words have been stretched from the original, which was widely deemed to mean criminal, as the concept of a foreign king being a criminal made little sense to early translators. Dr. Khan has researched this word back further and found an interesting thing. It became commonly used vernacular for all criminals in the 10th century, several decades after the events of Book 1 took place, during the famines, when virtually all individuals in prison were arrested for stealing food. Before that, it was referencing a much more specific type of criminal, and Dr. Khan has used this more specific term in her work throughout. So in this account, the leader of the opposing army is referred to only as the thief. 100,000 men that pass like ghosts, not cross the sea but round and round again, and all those in between, they clear the path. They keep walls barred and secrets locked within. For justice comes on swift and secret wings, like angels unseen to live taken flight. And justice is delivered unto three, and one who trails offense wherever he steps. The Onyla was where we made our stand. Our banners flew resplendent in the wind, and no force in this world could stand against Nihilit, greatest of us all, our lord, he who's loved by all the gods and men, fine of brow and swift of sword and speech, longest and finest emperor of Mede, bold where his predecessors were weak. The force shone golden in the noonday sun. From ocean shore to mountain peak they spread. Never had such numbers before been raised, and none could stand to stop such brave, strong men. Yet the heathen vagabonds took stand, fractured and disbanding as they stood, and led by that conniving, traitorous fool, the king, the thief, steals victories with lies. Magnificent the battle on the plain, Nihilid's force won time and time again. Barbarian hordes could barely hold a line, and their own men knew we were stronger still. But our gods and our army was yet betrayed by witchcraft and strange magic in the night, the thief with no respect for laws of man or those of nature to which all are bound. Shadows, demons passing in the night, throats slit in the dark before the dawn. We could not bring our arms or strength of men to these foul magics brought into our midst, and our brave leaders saw this and they knew. In face of this foul sorcery none could stand, the finest fighting force since start of time, betrayed by tricks and lies, foul shadow acts. The thief claimed victory and conquered land, his crown tarnished wherever it touched his brow, and all his lands would wither where he walked, the gods themselves sought to punish him for his evil acts upon their holy force, and though their vengeance comes not now with haste, his kingdoms may have held beneath his hand, but the land itself turned upon them all. In fire and rock and ash across the sky, the land of thieves and liars met its end, the final gift of gods against the thief, to punish him for standing up opposed to their chosen ruler of all the lands, the mighty Nihilid, the lord of all, he who ruled for near 100 years and brought to us great victory and peace. Thank you. I would enthusiastically recommend the full translation, with the caveat that it is clearly not an unbiased account. You can see how my people are not so keen on all our history coming from stories that call us shadows, demons, and liars. I could speak on this subject all day. However, I am nearing the end of my time, and I have one final performance for you. This one may be more familiar. It's a tune that has been co-opted in different contexts over the years and has traveled long distances across land and sea. I'm afraid I'm not playing the Hunterheads Top 10 single version or last decade's jazz swing arrangement. My university loves to take credit for this song, as it was written in Feria by the court music master at the time. But what they choose to forget is that before he came to the court, he was Aetolian. And although it has been reworked, covered, modernized, and played at weddings on every continent, it remains a distinctly Aetolian song. This is The Queen's Wedding Night, as my grandmother sang it to me, and her grandmother sang it to her. We have heard stories of the first king of Aetolis as a country, as a thief, as a king, and as a god. So now, let us consider that maybe he was a man. No more and no less. Or, more powerful still, a man in love.
I saw you dance in the garden, white flowers in your hair. When you were young and free from courts and crowns and cares. When you smiled, the whole world smiled, and when you laughed, all I wanted was to come to you and ask you to dance. Say, come away with me, we'll find a temple somewhere out of sight. And I would be your husband if you would be my wife. The years they come, they go, the flowers die and fall from the trees. You built a wall around your heart of stone and golden leaves. I walked shadows in your footsteps, saw rubies at your brow. You're stronger than the girl before, but oh, if she could see you now. I left gifts in your chamber in the middle of the night, and I would ask to be your husband if you would be my wife. I will leave behind my mountains, I will take upon your wars, give up my home and give my heart in return for yours. The jesters laugh and tease, and the poets tell their tales, and in these halls will be kings and queens with all that that entails. You'll believe nothing I tell you, but I swear this is no lie. I will be your husband if you will be my wife. Somehow we made it to this day. We made a promise set in stone. Tomorrow they will forge a golden crown and carve a golden throne. They say there is no chance for us, our history's too scarred. We are bruised and broken bodies with ever-hardened hearts. But in this room there are no demons except for yours and mine. And in this room I'll be your husband if you will be my wife. There's a whole world filled with darker things that look outside our doors, but we've a secret maze of passageways to keep us safe and warm. And in the endless dark of winter, I will offer you my hand. So when the spring grows fresh with blossom, I can hold you to a dance. Beneath the trees there are no kings or queens, there's only you and I. And here I am your husband, and here you are my wife.
Thank you. This has been The Myth, the Man, and the Menace, an oral history of King Eugenides of Attalus. I've been Dr. Caracas. You may know me online as Irrational Pie. There is a transcript of this talk on AO3 written by LC2L. I'll be here all weekend. Enjoy the rest of the conference, and good night.